Welcome to episode 429 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature a wonderful conversation with British-based music journalist and author Chris Charlesworth. And we talk with Mr. Charlesworth about his work with The Who and David Bowie, interviewing people like John Lennon. He tells us a firsthand story of Keith Moon throwing a television out of a hotel window, and shares a lot of insight about the music scene and some of these geniuses he had the great fortune to work with over the years, he himself being a major contributor to our sense of rock and roll. A grand conversation with Chris Charlesworth from his home outside of London. We also have an EW essay titled Who, and a poem called Studio. All of this, of course, will be imbued, infused with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It's so nice to be with you. Let's get to it. Episode 429 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. Languishing in a hotel room, bored stiff and boiling deep with the tumult of transgressions built up for years and years before you were born. Small towns, villages, cityscape, ocean sand, mountain top, riverside, you cannot hide. The television is thrown out the window. Downstairs, on the sidewalk, people are looking up to see the stars as they sneak out a side door into an alleyway and inside a big white limousine, off to another scene, packed with more people, ready to party and escape their lives for a little while. They chain smoke cigarettes and sing about the rebels, the deaf, dumb, and blind kid, teenage wasteland, heroes, peace, love, debauchery. And most of us cannot help to be inspired by their energy, philosophy, their art. This is a semblance of life that makes sense, seems genuine. It propels us, rescues us, breathes life for real. I remember seeing The Who back in 1982 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, at JFK Stadium. I was a high school kid there with my friends. I had been listening to their 45 on my parents' record player for at least one half decade. It fueled my sense of human contradiction and hypocrisy. Won't get fooled again. Its music and lyrics still resonate and drive me with the sense that we are on to the whole shebang bamboozle. I tip my hat to the new constitution, take a bow for the new revolution, smiling friends, change all around. I pick up my guitar and play, just like yesterday, and I get on my knees and pray. We won't get fooled again.
We'll be gone. In the- Hello?
Hello, Chris Charlesworth. Is that you?
Speaking.
It's so nice to have you on Troubadours and Rock On Tours. Thank you, sir, for taking out the time for us.
Well, it's a pleasure. It's good to be here. Or good to be there, I should say.
And where are you at the moment, actually, in the UK?
I'm in a little village where we live. It's called Gomshall, which is it's about an hour southwest of London.
An hour.
In the county of Surrey, the nearest big town is called Guildford.
Wonderful, thank you. It's nice to, it's nice to know where folks are. I'm in Scranton, Pennsylvania, as we speak, myself.
Yeah, that's on the East Coast. I'm not sure if I went there when I lived in America. I lived in America for most of the 1970s, as you may be aware. But I don't know whether I went to Scranton. I may have done. I don't know. I went to so many places.
Well, you were based in New York City when you were working for Melody Maker. Is that the...
That's right. Are we on air at the moment, or are we just...
Oh, yeah. This is...
We are. Okay, we're talking now. Well, hello out there. Yeah, I had the best job in the world, in fact. Well, I thought that was the case. From the middle of 1973 to the... to about the third or fourth month of 1977, I was Melody Maker's American editor, based initially in Los Angeles and then for much longer in New York.
Yeah.
This was a fantastic job. All I did was cover the rock scene, or cover the American rock scene, if you like, for our British readers. I was the third person, or the third staff member of Melody Maker, to do this job. And as things turned out, I did it for much longer than the other two. It was just a wonderful job. I had to work hard, mind, and I had to be self-motivated because I was on my own doing this. And the apartment where I lived in New York was my office. So I worked from home, which everybody does during COVID now. But anyway... I just had to produce so much copy or text week in, week out, and have it messengered over to Melody Maker in London. There were no faxes or emails in those days, so it all had to be typed out on sheets of paper and given to a messenger who put it on an aeroplane, and it got to London the next day. Every Thursday I did that.
That's
all that time.
That process makes it even seem more important, right, what you're doing, when you have to go through all of that physical sort of transfer of the information, getting it to somebody on a plane across the ocean. Now you just have
That's right. So it landed on the editor's desk on a Friday morning, what with the time change and everything, and overnight flight, and there'd been this package that I put together with interviews with all and sundry and show reviews and... reports on what was happening in New York on the music scene, and I'd package it all up, and along with photographs usually by my good friend Bob Gruen. You may be aware
of
Bob Gruen.
Of course,
probably
yes.
The best known rock photographer in New York, and he's been doing it since the late 1960s. In fact, that Bob was my photographer of choice. We became great friends during that period. We still are, for that matter. And I'd go on assignments, and I'd take Bob along with me. I remember we followed Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder review tour in 1975, in the autumn of 1975, together. Saw a few shows on that, and then I'd rush home, type it up. Bob would rush back to New York to his dark room in those days, of course. There was no digital photography. And then we get it all on a plane to London and hope for the best.
Oh, this is fascinating. I can't wait to get even more in depth with our discussion. I want to take a moment just for folks who maybe don't know who you are to share a little background. Any rocks musician or any rock fan certainly would, but there are those who may not. So let me share a little background. Chris Charlesworth is a British-based music journalist and author, and between 1983 and 2016, managing editor of Omnibus Press. He is particularly noted for his work about and with the great band The Who, for whom he has worked as an executive producer. Charlesworth also worked as David Bowie's publicist at RCA Records from 1979 to 1981.
Yep.
Having started his career as a journalist on the Craven Herald and Pioneer in his hometown of Skipton, Charlesworth began writing about music for the Bradford Telegraph.
That's right.
He wrote for... This is all credible.
Well, it was all a long time ago, but it's all correct.
And then again, Melody Maker from 1970 to 1977, being variously its news editor and its U.S. editor from 1973, based in New York City, and some notable interviews. I mean, this is an incredible list of interviews you did for Melody Maker.
This is about everybody who was up for being interviewed. The only ones I didn't get was Dylan and Elvis Presley, actually. I got pretty much everybody else.
Well, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, David Bowie, Led Zeppelin, The Who, Rod Stewart and the Faces, The Byrds, Bruce Springsteen, Elton John, The Beach Boys, Eric Clapton, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, The Band, Black Sabbath, Slade, Paul Simon, Alice Cooper, Traffic, Free, Santana, The Eagles, Deep Purple, Yes,
Frank Zappa.
Iggy Pop, and Bee Gees, Steely Dan, too, among others. That's amazing. That list, that's like a poem.
I know, it is. It sounds a lot, but in 7 years, what you have to bear in mind is that in those days, Melody Maker was a big selling paper. In fact, it was the biggest selling weekly music paper in the world. It doesn't exist anymore, thanks to the internet and computers. But in those days, at its peak, Melody Maker sold 200,000 copies a week.
Wow.
And the UK had a culture, a music press culture, that was like no other anywhere in the world. There wasn't just Melody Maker. There was New Musical Express, which was hot on our heels, selling about 180,000. There was another weekly paper called Sounds, which sold 100,000 a week. And then there were two smaller ones. Disc was one, and Record Mirror was the other, sold about 50 each. So if you tot all that lot up together, you'll see that there were about 500,000 music papers sold every week in the UK. Just in the UK, wow. Which is extraordinary, because today, now, 50, 60 years later, there isn't a single one.
Yeah, it's terrible.
It's a tragedy, really, isn't it? But there was this culture of the weekly music press that I was lucky enough to be a part of.
Did you, when you were at Melody Maker, I suppose you crossed paths with Alan Jones, right?
Oh, yeah, well, Alan came a little bit later. He arrived while I was in America, in fact. And Alan went on to a very distinguished career. Well, he became Melody Maker's editor, of course, which I didn't. I was just an associate editor, if you like. And then, of course, he went on to edit Uncut for many years as well, which was a monthly magazine. There was no culture of monthly magazines in those days like there is today, like Mojo in the UK and indeed Uncut. There were only all these weekly papers, and there was a lot of competition between us to snatch the interview with the big star of the week and to get news stories as well about groups splitting up and groups going on tour and events occurring in on the music scene, and so we were encouraged by our editor to get close to the groups to sort of befriend them so as we'd know what was going on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And I leapt into that. I loved it. You mentioned earlier on when you were sort of reading that bio that I actually left school and trained to be a newspaper reporter covering the sort of straight news stories that you would expect. You know, car crashes, accidents, fires, robberies, thefts, all the sort of things that you read about in regular papers, and a bit of sport even. But my hobby, if you like, my first love, was always rock music, ever since I first heard Elvis when I was about 10 years of age. And I'd always bought records and gone to shows. In fact, I played the guitar in little amateur bands, you know, covers bands. And so I was always really keen on music. And then when an opportunity came up to join the staff of Melody Maker. In fact, I answered an ad in the back of the paper, and I went for an interview, and the editor asked me about my, you know, love of music and what have you, so I babbled on, like I'm babbling on now, probably.
No, this is fascinating.
I've told him how much I loved The Who, which I did already, right, you know. And the editor said, good choice. And anyway, I got the job. This was in early 1970. And I got the job, and from that moment on, I've done nothing but work within the music world.
How old were you, like 19?
I was 23.
23?
I was 23 in 1970 when I got the job, so I was quite old, wasn't I? Well, I don't know, not really. So was most of the rest of the staff. We were all about the same age, and a lot of us had similar experience insofar as we'd worked on regular newspapers. On the newspaper in Bradford, I actually, me and another guy did a column once a week called The Swing Scene, which was the nearest thing there was to a rock and pop music column in this regular evening newspaper. And so I had a little bit of experience about writing about music. But one of the things I did for that newspaper in Bradford, which is a city in northern England, was I spoke on the phone to Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones about this new group he was forming called Led Zeppelin. And I had to ask him how to spell it. And I remember him telling me on the phone that they weren't going to appear on television and make singles. And this was very unusual at the time, you know, to the concept of a group that wasn't going to rely on making hit singles and appearing on TV. And I said, why don't you want to appear on television, Jimmy? And he said, because the sound's terrible on the little speakers coming out of TV.
Hey, he's an artist.
I would have heard of Led Zeppelin. Led Zeppelin were not big. They hadn't even, their first record was just released. Right? First album, Led Zeppelin 1, had just come out. And no one really knew who they were. And now I was giving an interview. Only on the phone, of course, but it was funny, when I finally met Led Zeppelin and went on tour with them, I reminded them of that. Oh, by the way, you don't know this, but I interviewed you before you were famous.
What an experience. You're part of the whole scene, obviously. I mean, to be an executive sort of producer for The Who and...
Oh, that came much later. That came much later, did that. Whilst I was on Melody Maker, I befriended The Who. There were two groups in particular that I befriended. One was The Who, the other one was Slade. Slade, who never really meant a great deal in America, I was lucky enough to see them well before they were famous and predict that they would be big, which they were in the UK. And something similar happened with Elton John, actually. I saw him before he was famous, and I gave him a good review, one of the very early reviews, saying this guy's going to be very popular one day, and sure enough, he was. But The Who were already popular when I joined Melody Maker. That Tommy had come out the previous year, and The Who were on they were on a flight to the heavens when I first started watching them regularly. But I'd already seen them twice before I joined Melody Maker. I thought they were fantastic on stage, because the great thing about The Who was the live show in those days. They were just the most exciting band in the world to watch. And so I sort of suggested to the editor, I love The Who so much, that if an opportunity came up to interview Townsend or Moon or whatever, then could I please do it, you know, because I really loved the group. And he said yes. And I'd been on the paper. This is quite funny, actually. I'd been on the paper for about 2 months, and there was a Who concert in a town called Dunstable, which is just north of London, and I went along to review it for Melody Maker. This is the first time I'd ever reviewed The Who. It's the first time I'd seen the group as a Melody Maker staff writer. And of course, I gave them a really good review, because they were just about at the height of their powers then in 1970-71. And about a week or two later, the phone rang on my desk in the office, and I picked it up, and he said, and so the voice on the other end of the phone said, hello, is that Chris? And I said, yeah. I said, it's Keith here, Keith Moon of The Who. I said, well, what's he ringing me up for? And he said he just wanted to ring me up to thank me for the good review. And that absolutely floored me. that Keith Moon would ring me up and thank me for giving The Who a good review. Now, The Who didn't really need a good review at that point in their career. They were already massive, you know. But I thought, well, what a nice thing to do. Now, it might be that Keith was, you know, trying to sort of butter me up a little bit, thinking, let's get this journalist, this writer on side. Who knows, right?
Right.
But Keith then said, let's meet. I'm often in this club, and he mentioned a club where he used to go drinking in Soho. And he said, come and say hello. And I did, actually. A week or two later, I met him, and I said, oh, you're Keith Moon. Chris Charlesworth, the bloke from Melody Maker. Oh, hello, have a drink, you know. And then he said, look, we're doing a show in Hammersmith, that's a suburb of West London, in a few weeks' time. Come along with me, be my guest, right? And so I did. I went to this show with Keith in his Rolls-Royce car, right? And that night I met the other three blokes in The Who, and that was it, really. I became the sort of Melody Maker's Who correspondent, if you like. And so I saw them about another 30 times over the next few years, up to the point when Keith died. And I interviewed them all many times, and I went on tour. I travelled with them on the road and on aeroplanes and this sort of thing. And I got to know them all very well. And much later on, I got involved in the project which was with them, which was to, when their CDs were being reissued, sort of upgraded, if you like, and I got involved in the sequencing and suggesting tracks for bonus tracks and that sort of thing, and this culminated in the box set 30 years of Maximum R&B, and Pete asked me to get involved with that, and in fact I ended up being co-producer of that, which meant that I put the packaging together for them, essentially. I commissioned the text for the booklets and selected the photographs in the booklet and worked with the designer on it and went through loads of pictures as to what picture we should have on the cover. And also I worked with John Astley, who was actually Pete Townsend's brother-in-law, in the studio, sequencing the tracks in what order they should go over the four CDs, and indeed which songs to put on, and looking through Pete's library to find unreleased tracks that we thought would enhance the box set as a whole, because we didn't just want to fill it up with stuff that people had already bought, you know. So that was wonderful, actually, finally working for The Who. But in point of fact, when I left Melody Maker, I worked for a brief period in New York with a company there that looked after their American affairs. So by this time, I'd got my feet under the table a bit with The Who, if you know what I mean. That's an English expression.
Yeah.
I still love them. I mean, I'm not as close to them nowadays. I'm retired nowadays as I used to be. But I'm very proud of my association with The Who, And, of course, I've written several books about them, too. I've got four at the last count.
Yeah, where could people find those books?
They're not all still available. The most recent one was Tommy at 50. Pete wrote an introduction for this one. This one was published last year, well, 2 years ago now, actually, in 2019. It's the 50th anniversary of Tommy coming out. And... well, you can find them on Amazon. Just key in Tommy at 50, and you'll find it.
Tommy at 50 by Chris Charlesworth.
That's right. It's called Tommy at 50. That's the most recent one. The other ones are quite old now, but you can still find them on Amazon, I think.
You're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest.
And is all the mythology around the Who with regard to their, you know, wildness accurate?
To a degree, yes. I think it's exaggerated, and I think the members of the Who have done their best to exaggerate it, because it's a good story, isn't it? Certainly Keith could be a bit of a handful, let's say.
You always hear that story about how he would throw televisions out of hotel rooms and stuff like that.
Yeah, I actually saw that happen once. It was in Charlotte, South Carolina, actually, 1971, after a show. We're about eight floors up when the telly went out the window. And the funny thing was, after he'd done it, right, there was a tremendous crash. Of course, it was late in the evening, so there was no one below. But we knew that the night porter or whatever night manager would come up and complain. But Keith was kind of used to this kind of thing and dealing with this kind of problem. So when this bloke came up, he convinced him that it was an accident and that he was moving the television from one location to another. And it slipped out of his hand by the window. And terrible accident. It slipped out of his hand and fell out of the window. What a shocking thing to happen. And he actually persuaded this bloke almost that it was an accident. It was funnier to listen to him trying to explain it away as an accident than it was actually chucking the TV set out the window in the first place. and then, cheeky as he is, when this guy was asking, he said, "Oh, if you're going downstairs, could you bring us up some more drinks, please?" and then, just as the guy was going, and perhaps another television set. Absolute scream he was, really.
He seems like, from what little I've witnessed on a video and the like, a very charming person. So I could see that.
Sometimes he could get on your nerves, and I'm sure the other members of the Who, he got on their nerves many a times, because the amount of money that was expended, let's say, as a result of his misdemeanors, it came out of everybody's money.
Out of the general fund,
And Roger, who was the exact opposite of Keith, Roger went to bed sober and early, often accompanied by an overnight companion, if you get my drift.
Mm-hmm.
But by the by, Roger wouldn't break anything ever, and he only ever had a few glasses of beer. He wasn't a wild man at all, and he got a bit miffed, let's say, when he saw the tour accounts at the end of the tour. And he saw several thousand dollars had gone down as a result of Keith's behavior. And it came, he had to pay for it, as did the other two.
Well, let me ask you a question about another person that I revere, really, in terms of his artistic capability and work, is David Bowie. What was it like working with David Bowie as his publicist?
Well, first of all, I should say that I met David and wrote about him when I was working for Melody Maker, of course. David Bowie emerged in about 1971, became a big star then in the UK at first, and like everybody else, I went to see him and thought he was absolutely terrific. And Melody Maker was one of the first magazines to feature him on the front page and predict that he was going to be a massive star. It was actually one of my colleagues, Michael Watts, who did the famous interview with him when David said that he was gay. Now, I don't believe he was, to tell you the truth. I think he was just saying it because he knew he'd get headlines. But that was what Bowie was like. He was a master of manipulating the media. But so David Bowie and Melody Maker had a good relationship, and we featured him many times on our front page. We had lots of interviews with him. I did one extensive interview with him in 1976 when I went on tour when he was right about the time the album Station to Station came out, and he did a tour of America. And he was, this was what they called a white light tour, when there was mm-hmm. only white light on stage. And I just as an aside, is this, that I went to see him in Detroit on that tour. And later on, I read an interview with Madonna. And she said that the first ever rock show she ever went to see was seeing David Bowie in Detroit in April, I think it was, 1976.
Yeah, that's where
and
she's
I thought
from.
To myself,
yeah.
Well, crikey, that's the same show I was at. So I could have been sat next to Madonna for all that. I don't think I was, but she might have been just behind me. Anyway,
Madonna Ciccone.
So I already knew David, and I interviewed him then. And I'd met him a few times, like socially at events, you know, in clubs. So when I left Melody Maker, and after I'd worked for this company in New York that looked after the Who's affairs, I came back to the UK, and I worked for RCA Records in their press office. I was the chief press officer there. And David Bowie, of course, was signed to RCA, and so he was the biggest act on the label, and I became his press officer for about a couple of years, not very long really. This was the time when Lodger came out and Scary Monsters,
mm-hmm.
and he lived in New York at the time, and I was in London, so it's not like we saw a lot of him. But one of the David Bowie was a very intelligent man.
Yes. That's obvious.
I think everybody probably knows this now.
Yeah.
He was very, very widely read. And although he was most famous for as a songwriter and singer, he was multicultural in a way that, I mean, he appreciated fine art, painting, he appreciated literature, he appreciated the theater, he appreciated films. He could talk, interestingly, on any of these subjects. And he could charm the pants off anyone. He was very nicely spoken, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
He was very gracious. He was very polite and well-mannered. And people just fell in love with him as a person. He could have been anyone, you know, not just a singer and what have you. He was just such a genial, interesting man to be with. And people like that are easily bored. And whenever I set up one or two interviews for people to talk to him, and in those days it was like, you know, you get an hour with David Bowie, you know. I had to tell people you get an hour. And these journalists would say to me, they'd say, oh, I want longer than an hour. And I said, well, look, it's up to you, I'd say. If you can interest David, right, if you can get him interested in you, then it'll probably go on for longer because he won't cut you off. He'll only cut you off if he's bored. So don't bore him, whatever you do. And another thing I noticed with David was when he was being interviewed and what have you, he would talk to the... He would ask the interviewer things. He would say, have you seen any good films recently? Have you read any good books? Have you been to the theatre? Have you seen any good plays? So he would use the interview to gain information for himself.
He was having a conversation.
Yeah, he'd have a conversation. But also, he was a little bit of a vacuum cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
If he thought that whoever was interviewing him was on the same length, the same wavelength, then he might gain some information from the interviewer that might be useful to him in his career.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So if he'd say something like, have you met any good photographers? Are there any new photographers around? And if the interviewer said something like, oh, yeah, there's such and such a guy, he's really good, then David might look up his work and think, oh, he might be someone I might want to take pictures of me.
Right.
Did you see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
And it's very unusual for that because most artists, as I've discovered when I did so many interviews for MM, like they just answer the questions and that's it, you know. But Bowie was far more conversational in his modus operandi, and I found that fascinating. And I also thought how clever he was.
Right, it speaks to us. Yes,
how clever he was. He was using the interview. Okay, it might be a bit of a bore for him being interviewed yet again, you know, but he was using the interview for whatever purpose he could get out of it as well.
It speaks to his high level of intelligence.
He never struck me as being particularly healthy, I have to say. When I knew him, anyway, he virtually chain-smoked cigarettes. 30 or 40 a day.
Wow. Wow.
One after the other. One after the other, yeah. The only time he didn't smoke was when he was on stage.
So maybe that was the demise of his health right there.
I think so. I don't think it's any secret that he was a heavy smoker. I think maybe towards the end of the life he'd managed to give it up, right, when he realized how bad it was for him. But and it was cancer, of course, that felled him, you know. So there you go. The three most interesting interviews that I did for Melody Maker was Bowie was one. See, when I interviewed, one time I interviewed him, he told me he was broke. He told me he had no money, right? And that the only reason he was touring was to shore up his bank account. Now, this was probably a lie. I mean, yeah, he lived in great luxury. You know, he had a chauffeur-driven limousine taking him everywhere, and people who are broke don't have chauffeur-driven limousines. But the point was, he knew that if he said that, then this would stand out, and it would be a headline. David, I'm broke,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Bowie says he's only touring for the money, right? And so he knew that I'd pick up on this. Any journalist would pick up on a statement like that, and it would ensure him of a headline.
Wow, master.
Master he was at manipulating the media, I think. So as I say, David was such a great interview, because anybody who interviewed him will have come away with reams and reams of tapes recorded. We used tapes, cassette tapes in those days. And they don't know where to start. You've got so much great quotes from him, you know. And the other two was Townsend. Pete was a fabulous interviewer as well. And he's a little bit the same as Barry, but not quite as much. But Pete was controversial. He'd say all sorts of things that had scream headlines. I hate the Beatles. He'd say something like that, you know.
Right. And did he mean that, or was he just trying to get attention to?
No, just say Beatles make lousy records. Pete would say something like that. You know? I'm not saying I'm just coming up with that, or you know, drugs are good for you. You know, he would say something like that. You know? And the other one, and the third one, of course, was John Lennon. And Lennon was just too honest, really. If anything, it got him into trouble, didn't it? Those three were the three best interviews. I never actually interviewed any of the Rolling Stones. I never had any dealings with them. Other reporters snagged them, but my favorites were Lennon, Bowie, and Townsend every time.
And was there a common thread that you found in all of them? A common trait that you found in all three of them?
Yeah, they were all the kind of people in another life, if the educational system had been better, they'd have got on to study philosophy at Cambridge or something like that. They were all really bright.
And good people, would you say, too?
They're really bright, and you don't have to go to get a degree to be bright. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you're born bright. Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, they were all born bright, they were. They were inquisitive, bright, you know, and could think on their feet, you know what I mean? They could have been, you know, QCs, lawyers, who knows what, right, bankers. They could have made a fortune in any field they choose to work in, I think. They were all really bright.
How about, like, egos? Were their egos huge to the extent?
Oh, yeah. Well, yes and no. You've got to have a bit of an ego to get to where you are, but I don't think any of those three allowed their egos to engulf them, if that's the right way of putting it, you know. I don't think any of them were vain either. I mean, David always looked good. David was always smartly dressed and neatly combed hair and what have you. So you could say he was slightly vain in that respect, but it was only because he was interested in clothes and fashion. Whereas the other two didn't give a hoot what they looked like.
It's just interesting because all three of these gentlemen that you bring up, I think, have reached deeply many, many, many human beings and will continue to through their work. And so to hear how they were as individuals and hear a good sort of review, so to speak, from you about how they are as individuals is endearing.
Yeah,
is nice.
They didn't take fools, suffer fools gladly, as the cliche goes, either. You know, they were. They all knew that they were at the highest level of their chosen fields, And it was a privilege to get to know them, actually, and to see them operating. You can say they're all flawed. I mean, there's probably a flaw in David that he smoked as much as he did. They were all promiscuous as well. You want me to deal with that kind of thing?
Well, the opportunity
was... All of them were unfaithful to their wives. They were all extremely attractive to women, probably because of this as well. But they'd all seen. I think that there's something must touch you in the head when you stand on a stage, and there's 50,000, 100,000 people screaming at you. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It must do. You've got to be pretty tough mentally to be able to deal with that night after night. The Beatles couldn't deal with it, of course. The Beatles had to give it up in 1966 because it just got too much for them and they couldn't hear themselves play. And so John really didn't have the experiences that David and Pete did in terms of the touring arenas and stadiums in the 70s that the Who did and Bowie did. You know what I mean? He gave up performing, right? So he didn't hear it. But Pete and David would have looked out on an audience of 100,000 people night after night after night on tour and pleased them, as indeed to someone like Springsteen now and lots of others. I'm just talking about the ones I really knew. And it must do something to your head to see all these people worshipping you, mustn't it?
Oh, my Lord, yeah.
I was lucky enough to stand at the side of the stage for a lot of these shows, and especially with The Who, and look out and see this audience roaring at them, as they were playing Tommy and Won't Get Fooled Again and their big hits, and see the effect they had on the audience. It's quite something if you just stood at the side of the stage. So what it must be if you're actually producing the music that's creating this huge excitement.
As you said.
That must be quite something to in your head, to be able to do this.
And not to lose yourself in it, as you said earlier.
Yeah, not to lose yourself and to be able to hold it together, right? The Who, one of the interesting things about The Who is that even by the time they made their first records in 1965, they'd already played more shows as an unknown act, if you like, than Led Zeppelin did throughout their entire career.
Interesting.
Because they started as schoolboys.
Right, so they're seasoned road warriors, so to speak. They know.
Yeah. When they first started, the only way to make any money was by playing live, and so they've got a thousand shows under their belt by the mid '60s. Led Zeppelin's entire career, they did about 600, I think. So, the number of concerts they'd done. It's what made them what they were. And it was the same with the Beatles to a certain extent when you look back at it, because the number of shows they did in Liverpool at the Cavern Club and in Hamburg before they were famous was probably about the same. The hours they'd put in learning their craft. I'm going off on a tangent here. What was the question?
I think you're answering the questions before I even ask them. You've crafted a nice narrative actually in our conversation. We're just about getting to the end of it because of time constraints of the show.
Okay.
But I do want to remind everybody we're talking with Chris Charlesworth, British-based music journalist and author, among other things, and
retired now, really. I have a blog that I do called Just Backdated.
And
are you aware of that?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
And how often do you?
I started it in 2014, 2013. My daughter got me to do it, actually. She kept saying, "Daddy, you're always telling me these stories. Why don't you put them down on paper?" So I did. I started this blog, and it's called Just Backdated because that's Duck Buddy Young, but I'm just backdated after Substitute, the Who song.
I love that.
And I've got over 900 posts on it now, so Some of it's new stuff, some of it's old stuff, some of it's memoirs. I review a lot of books on it because, as I say, we've never mentioned this, but after I left Bellymaker and RCA Records, I became the managing editor of a company called Omnibus Press, which publishes rock books, and I wrote a few myself, and I was responsible for, 500 or 600 books being published, I would think. And so book reviews are kind of my specialty now. But I review the odd records or shows I go and see. Not that anyone can see many these days, unfortunately. And so if anyone's interested, they can look at Just Backdated Blogspot, and they'll find my writings there.
And also Tommy at 50 is out there.
Tommy at 50. That's the last book I did.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, right, you know, given all the experience you have and all, you know, all the work you've done, to share what drives and what influences, what challenges the artists that we all have come to look at as part of our lives over the last several decades. You know, thank you for all that work, first of all. That's a huge component.
Yeah, I love it. I loved it. I mean, I was so lucky that I got paid for it. You know?
Right, you are.
You're doing something you love. I mean, I like writing and I like rock and roll music, and to be able to, you know, bring the two together and forge a career through it was just a dream come true. I was so lucky. I've been so lucky. I have to be able to do it. And I'm retired now, but I'm fortunate that I have some savings and a good pension from all the years I put in on Omnibus, which is part of a much bigger company. And so I can, you know, live in a comfortable retirement. I'm 73 now, so, you know, I'm...
That's the new 53, you know, I understand. 73 is the new 53, so you're good
to go. Yeah, absolutely. I'm sitting here in my little office, which used to be my daughter's bedroom in our house. I'm surrounded by books and CDs, and there's a couple of guitars here as well, because I still play a bit, or try to play anyway. And I love it, you know. I've loved it. I've had a very, very fortunate life, I have. So, you know, and if anybody who's enjoyed what I've written, great, you know, there you go.
Well, I appreciate it, Mr. Charlesworth. Thank you so much for being on Troubadours.
That's
and Rock
a pleasure,
and Tours.
A pleasure. Okay. All right. Thanks. Good talking to you.
Nice talking with you again. Hopefully we can talk again in the future.
I hope so. Okay. Bye-bye.
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 studio. A hole in the ceiling above the dark mahogany staircase, created as a Baldwin spinet, was tipped on its side to maneuver a position that would allow the piano to sit in the second floor studio, next to a wall adjacent to the door that leads to a balcony overlooking the very green garden of trees, bushes, and high grass.
Show some emotion. Put expression in your eyes. Light up. If you're feeling happy. But if it's bad, then let those tears roll down.
And there you have it, episode 429 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Chris Charlesworth, and these musical artists: Thelonious Monk, John Lennon, The Who, Led Zeppelin, Joan Armatrade, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard, too. And of course, I would like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's give it a go and do our best with this time. Take care.